This is XTP Media.
And realised also that he was a very natural pilot, allowed us to extend the envelope as it was. Yeah. Politics, money, etc.
Yeah.
I didn't like it.
No, yeah, okay.
And I was very pleased to get out of it and have a breath of fresh air.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson from XTP Media, and welcome to episode 88 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. First, I'd like to wish my fellow co-presenter, Gareth Stringer, from Global Aviation Resource, a speedy recovery from surgery, and we look forward to having both Gareth and Tim Robinson back very soon. Today's episode, in this year of 100 years of the Royal Air Force, is a real insight to military flight operations, the strategic defence reductions, and inter-service rivalry. Today, we have the honour of speaking to Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Johns, CBE, and Fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society. Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Johns was commissioned at the RAF College Cranwell in 1959, after completing flying training on Piston Provost and Meteor aircraft. For the next 9 years, apart from a short intermission as an ADC, he served as an operational fast jet pilot flying Javelin night fighters and then fighter recce hunters operating from Aden and Amman. Thereafter, he qualified as a flying instructor, initially on the NAT and then the Jet Provost as a squadron commander at Cranwell. In his last year as a flying instructor, he taught the Prince of Wales to Wings Standard. Two tours in the RAF Germany Harrier Force preceded a succession of national and NATO senior appointments, culminating in his promotion to Chief of the Air Staff and Air ADC to the Queen. On retirement in April 2000, he became Constable and Governor of Windsor Castle. A past Chairman of the Board of Trustees of the RAF Museum, he is now President of the RAF Historical Society. His illustrious career gave him the privilege of a rare, if not singular, perspective of the RAF, their sister services, and national defence matters. He witnessed a steady decline in the combat power of the UK's armed forces, as financial management took precedence over identifying strategic priorities and maintaining the vital skill set of service personnel. His views are insightful and forthright, balanced and thought-provoking. His autobiography, Bolts from the Blue, From Cold War Warrior to Chief of the Air Staff, is published by Grub Street Books and is available in the UK, US and Canada from November 2018 onwards. It's essential reading for anyone interested in the development of Allied air power over the last 50 years. Without further ado, let's talk to Sir Richard Johns, CBE. I'm here with Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Johns, formerly Chief of the Air Staff, Royal Air Force. Sir Richard, welcome to Extended.
Thank you.
You appear to have flown almost everything in the Royal Air Force inventory. Your career spanned much of the Cold War, and you've had the great honour of and responsibility of training Royal Highness Prince Wales. What do you recall with most pleasure through this really fascinating career?
I think probably in terms of flying aeroplanes, the The tour that I remember with particular pleasure was my 2 years out in Aden, flying the Hunter Fighter Recce 10, or the FR-10, which has been described, I think, quite rightly, as the best of breed. Absolutely lovely aeroplane, and if I ever was given the opportunity of flying one more trip in my life before I depart this mortal coil, I think I'd probably choose the Hunter 10.
Yeah.
But then beyond that, the time I spent in the Harrier Force, two tours in the Harrier Force with a very, very unique aeroplane, was extremely exciting. And sort of getting on top of that aeroplane was, you know, I say an achievement. We all had to achieve it, but it was something that I'm quite proud of doing,
yeah.
And particularly proud of the people I associated with at the time.
Yeah, and you come across in the book, which we'll talk about in a moment, as being very much a pilot first and a leader in the Air Force and working with government second. Can I go right back to the beginning in terms of how you start the book? The thing that literally made me laugh out loud was your adventure in the Tiger Moth and being strapped in or not. Do you just want to... Should we kick the discussion off there?
Well, I was at Portsmouth Grammar School. I was in the Combined Cadet Force, and I was obviously very eager to fly and very fortunate to get a flying scholarship. And this was back in 1956, shortly before I joined the Royal Air Force. And that meant that one went down to Portsmouth Aero Club, and I think they had a contract with whatever it was at the time, the Air Ministry, to teach people like myself, once you reach the age of 17, give you 30 hours flying to get a private pilot's license. And the flying was done on the Tiger Moth. And so we kicked off down there, and I'd gone solo. In a reasonable time. I can't remember precisely how long, probably about 8-9 hours, I would guess. And then not all that long afterwards, my flying instructor, who actually was a, you know, a fairly elderly gentleman, he had actually flown in the Royal Flying Corps during the First World War. He said, he was very Scottish, and I won't try and emulate his accent, but he said, right, he said, well, now have a look at some aerobatics. And he did a couple of little loops, which, of course, in a Tiger Moth, he just whizzed around, you know, and fell probably little barrel rolls and so on. And he then sort of turned the aeroplane upside down to show me, you know, negative G. Well, you know, I was quite a large lad. And as the aeroplane went upside down and the my weight took on, I suddenly realised, I can't remember it too vividly, except I was bloody frightened. I felt this sort of shearing sound, or felt it down my side. And the lap harness sheared. And all of a sudden, you know, I was sort of hanging on it anyway. I found my feet underneath the instrument panel, hanging on for grim life to the combing.
Upside down.
And, of course, you have a Gosport tube, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
And that was now some way away from me. And I was saying, hey, hey, hey. And he thought, as I understand it, that this was, you know, cheerful noises in the back.
Yeah.
And eventually he rolled the thing the right way up. And I presume, again, like most aeroplanes, it couldn't have been more than 15 seconds, because otherwise the engine would have conked out. And I then explained to him my, you know, what happened. I didn't have a parachute.
Yeah.
We were over Langston Harbour, which is a great big mud flat, you know, amongst little harbours around Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And I don't think he believed me, but we went back and we landed at the club. And then he came out and I showed him what had happened. And I didn't realise, far too naive at the time, but he probably thought, oh, God, there goes the contract.
Yeah.
And he just said to me, he said, not a word to anyone, Sonny. And that was it. And I never did until, well, many years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you went on to fly aircraft like the Meteor.
Yeah.
But you had some interesting times at Cramwell, in particular in the early days. And one of the things I took from reading about some of those experiences is you started to form some of your opinions very early on in your career about what felt right and what felt wrong. You know, some of those early year disciplines, you were even experiencing them and thinking, this just doesn't feel like a modern Air Force.
I don't think quite that. Remember that when I joined the Air Force, the Air Force was full of people, you know, who had fought with great gallantry in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And it was they still had their imprint on the Air Force. And I don't think that when I was at Crammell, I was making judgments about, you know, whether it was a good Air Force, whether it was necessary to have a rapid advancement in change and so on. I think that the biggest sort of influence on one's life at Crammell, and remember it was 3 years, was to get out of the place. It was to actually, you know, I survive. I don't mean survive in the sense of living, but to actually pass all the flying tests through basic flying training, advanced flying training, get your wings, get commissioned, and then get out into the Air Force proper and do a proper job in the Air Force.
Yeah.
I think that was the thing that I felt strongly about at the time.
Right.
Having said that, there were, at the time, I thought one or two absurdities in the training, like, you know, having to bull rifles and scrape all that sort of stuff, that sort of thing and the rest of it. And it's true that certainly some of my own entry, to their dying day, in fact, I've got a friend not so far away who died, sadly, quite recently. You know, he to this day, or until he died, would say, God, I hated the place.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a complete waste of time because, you know, I think it's a fact we spent more time on the drill square than we did flying aeroplanes or doing academics.
Yeah.
I think that's true, but even if it is, it was a pretty close-run thing.
I think I picked that up from your story. But you mentioned there people who had significant history, shall we say, both the First and the Second World War. Can I ask you, of all the people you've worked with, who do you admire the most?
Gosh. I think a man who two people in particular, I think, amongst my seniors, and that was when I went back to Crammell as ADC, the Commandant.
Yeah.
I mean, Air Vice Marshal, he was an Air Commodore at the time, but Air Vice Marshal Michael Lyne was a quite outstanding aviator with 3 Air Force crosses. I mean, shot down just before the Battle of Britain, very, very badly wounded.
Yeah.
He was in hospital the whole time and the battle was raging. He was on the same squadron as Douglas Bader on 19 Squadron, and he was very badly wounded in one leg. Douglas Bader told him to have it off. And Michael did say to me once, he said, well, Douglas wasn't always right about everything because I didn't have it off. And then he came back in flying again once he was fit to fly. And, I mean, his logbook was absolutely astonishing. He was the chief gunnery instructor in the Desert Air Force. And he flew just about every Luftwaffe aeroplane to flight test it, test its weapon systems and so on as they were captured, you know, as we overran German airfields in the desert and so on. And he was a very clever and a very astute man as well, with a lovely sense of humour, who taught me so much when I look back on it. I mean, he really was a huge influence. And the other man, who was his assistant commandant, who I also used to work for at the time, was the great Al Dare, who, of course, was one of the great heroes of the Battle of Britain, who was one of the most formidable characters and one of the nicest men, again, it's ever been my pleasure to meet.
Yeah.
But then after that, I did have the pleasure and honour working for many other very distinguished people.
And you talk regularly about those who've influenced you in different ways throughout your life. How would you describe, I suppose, your style of leadership?
Avuncular? I'm not quite sure.
Because someone doesn't rise to the position of Chief of the Air Staff without being a spectacular leader, because you're leading both an organisation, but particularly human beings, and you make no bones about.
Well, I think that I think there are three things. First of all, is trust. You've got to be professional. People have got to trust your professionalism. This, of course, is as true in peacetime as it is in war. That you're not going to get them unnecessarily killed. So you've got to be professional, you've got to know your business, and they've got to recognize, you know, that when you ask them to do things, you're asking them to do things knowing full well the consequences of getting it wrong. That's professionalism. The other thing, I think, which goes hand in hand with that, is trust in you as an individual. that they trust you, that they know that you are, you know, a true person. Your instinct is not to sort of cheat or lie to get yourself out of trouble. If you're in trouble, you'll stand up for it. You stand up yourself, take it on the chin, or whatever. So I think that that element of character is important. And I suppose people will say that's some form of moral, as a moral element of leadership. And I don't claim by any stretch of the imagination to be absolutely perfect. Please don't let me give you that impression.
No.
We all make errors and so on. And one or two I made, you know, to this day, shame me. The third thing is communication. You've got to be able to communicate. And communication is more than just talking, like you and I are talking to one another. It's being on net with people. I mean, to give you a very coarse example, if you're talking to a bunch of your officers in a crew room, you're going to go and do something or whatever, the way that you may address them, both in tone, language, content, and so on, is probably going to be different from the way that you'll go and talk to a bunch of very junior airmen who've just joined your squadron, and you're going to go out into the mud and muck of the middle of Germany in the Harrier force and so on. And the way, as I say, the way you're going to talk to them is probably going to be different.
Yeah.
And so I think that communication is an art that you develop as you grow more experienced, as you grow older, as you meet different people. And likewise, you know, if you're dealing with politicians, soldiers, sailors, or whatever, you want to think about what you're going to say, and more importantly, perhaps, you want to, well, equally importantly, you have to think about how you're going to say it.
Let me take the point you just made there about soldiers and sailors, because in the role that you rose to, but more importantly in some of your middle and senior ranking roles, it was absolutely crucial to work with the other services.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the Harrier force in Germany. I want to come back and ask you about flying it, but I'll come back flying the Harrier, but we'll come back to that. You were very clear that particularly the Royal Engineers and the Royal Signals were a key success factor in the Harrier force in Germany.
Yes.
Why do you think this inter-service collaboration worked so well?
Do you know, I've never, in a sense, tried to analyse it specifically. When the Harrier force deployed into the field, it obviously needed communications. And the communications had to be communications that not only you had inter-site communications between the wing operations centre, deployed separately from the flying sites. You all had to be able to talk to one another, obviously, for tasking and debriefing and so on. But you had to have a communication network which would allow you to talk to Army Corps, Air Support Operations Centre, and then back to 2ATAF and so on. So the communications were absolutely essential to the operation. And the only people who had the capability to do it in those days, and it was known as the Bruin system, were the Royal Signals.
Right.
And obviously, because you know the Royal Air Force was such an important part in Germany of supporting army operations in the very broadest sense of achieving local air superiority, close air support, battlefield air interdiction, and the rest of it, they recognized that we were a very important part of the air-land battle. And if we were going to fulfill our part in it, we had to have good communications. And the Signals Regiment, who worked with the Royal Air Force, not just the Harrier Force, 21st Signals Regiment it was, they came out with us in the field, but they also did the communications on the main operating bases back in the clutch airfields, Wildenrath, Bruggen and Larbrook. So they were absolutely essential. Royal Engineers are a slightly different kettle of fish. They have, when deployed, quite unbelievable ferocious energy. When you give them a job to do, I mean the way they go at it is, boy, it makes you sort of almost want to weep. But the war warlock, you know, the war operation required these very secret locations to be prepared for occupation by aeroplanes, people, weapons, fuel, and so on. And without that, We couldn't have an off-base concept of operations relying on survival through dispersal and concealment. Yeah. So you had to have people who could go and knock things down, build things quickly, and so on. And, of course, we practiced this all 3 times a year in peacetime. And, in fact, setting up the peacetime flying sites and keeping us flying on them, off them, was probably, well, it wasn't probably, it was damn sight more challenging than actually operating the war sites would have been.
Yeah.
You know, operating on fields as opposed to on roads and things like that and so on. And I think that, how can I put it, when you had a site of 150 people or ranks, I forget what the percentage would be, but of those 150, probably 60 odd would probably be soldiers from either the signals or the Royal Engineers.
Hmm.
And, you know, they sort of, how can I put it, they sort of came into the concept and they realized that they were an absolutely integral part of the operation, and without them, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read about. And, of course, the Harrier is probably a better description, is unique.
Yeah.
As a pilot, you were adamant that you wanted to fly that aircraft. I think, you know, you were...
Well, that's not quite true.
Okay.
No, because, you know, when I was doing it, I'd done, finished flying instructing.
Yeah.
I then did staff college.
Yeah.
I then went out to Cyprus, you know, to work for the commander-in-chief out there. And when I look at, you know, I thought, if I get promoted, I would have been out of the front line now for about 6 or 7 years, something like that. What's the best job I could expect if I get promoted to wing commander?
Hmm.
And my view at the time was to go back to Valley to be the chief flying instructor there. I think we're talking now, what, 73-ish?
Yeah.
I think the Nat was... I don't think they had moved over to the Hawk by then. I can't exactly remember.
I don't think they had.
But I'd been an instructor there on the Nat, and I really enjoyed flying the Nat. I thought the Nat was a super little aeroplane. I thought, well, if I go back there as chief flying instructor, yeah, that's fine. And then quite out of the blue... bolts on the blue, came this posting as a Harrier squadron commander.
Yeah.
Which did shake me, I have to admit.
Tell me what the Harrier was like to fly, because helicopters, we all sometimes laugh at, that, you know, that goes against the grain in terms of natural flight. But is the Harrier in that category as well?
I think it's in a... Because remember, before we flew the Harrier... went to the operational conversion unit at Wittering.
Yeah.
We all went up to Shawbury, I think it was RAF Shawbury, and we did about 7 trips in a whirlwind.
Yeah.
And the idea being basically, you sort of drew an instructor, he did all the hard work, like starting and stopping the thing and the checks, was just to show us, you know, hovering, getting used to using marker boards, and things like that. But of course, the techniques you use for flying a helicopter were vastly different from the techniques you used to fly a Harrier. My own feeling, I mean, when one went to Wittering, we were lucky. By then, there was a two-seater. My admiration for the guys who flew it without even having had a two-seater beforehand is undimmed.
Yeah.
But we did a couple of trips dual, which were using, where we used just 65 nozzle type landings, slowing the aeroplane down, getting used to the cockpit and all the rest of it. Then you went solo, and then you were introduced by your QFI, and I've written quite a bit about this in the book, to the whole business of decelerating. They had this vast chunk of concrete at Wittering called Bravo North, and then you would hover over that, and then you would go down, and you landed. And then, of course, my instructor showed, you know, he taught me through my first vertical takeoff, which is an absolute bloody disaster. Mm. I mean, the aeroplane just whizzed over onto its right-hand side.
You used to have to use heavy rudder, didn't you?
Well, not for the takeoff. I mean, no, the point was that when you were coming in, the critical speed band was roughly about 90 knots down to 30 knots.
Yeah.
And then you had to make sure that you kept the aeroplane pointing into the relative airflow.
Yeah.
So if you had so you had to be very, very conscious of the use of rudder.
Yeah.
You had this wind vane out the front, you know, which was a very simple piece of technology, but by God, it was important. You were feeding on power at the same time that you were coming back on the nozzles. You were watching the engine temperature. Mm. You were watching the angle of attack. I mean, and then of course you had to do your vital actions, as you came into the hover.
Yeah.
When you first started, this I certainly found quite a handful.
It's a heavy workload.
What they told you when you started, I remember this very clearly. The guy who ran Basic Squadron at Wittering was a fellow called Squadron Leader Ken Jones. And I always remember his opening words. There were seven of us on my course. And he said, well, welcome to the Harrier OCU. Harrier, easy plane to fly, easy plane to crash. And those were his first words. And what he meant was, in this rather critical speed band, if you stayed within the operating limits, you were going to be fine.
Yeah.
If you strayed outside those operating limits, the aeroplane would bite, and it would bite very, very quickly indeed. Yeah. And most sadly, it did kill a number of people.
Yeah.
Problem with the limits were, of course, were they were pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that I think the people like myself who had done quite a bit of flying beforehand probably took more time to get used to it than the guys who had come straight through training.
Right, okay.
Who probably, what is the word,
they familiarised
with it more quickly than chaps like myself did.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
I've got lots of routes to go now, but I just want to go back to instructing, actually. You're quite passionate about instructing, and you seem to enjoy it a great deal. Tell me what His Royal Highness Prince Charles was like to teach. What were the challenges you faced there?
Well, I think going back one, I was not passionate about instructing. I was not a volunteer to go to Central Flying School when I left Aden. And a chap out on 1417 flight with me said, well, you must do basic instructing. Mm. That's the only thing. Well, when I went to Little Risington and I flew the Jet Provost Mark III for the first time, I thought, not on your Nelly. I thought it was the most silly, boring little aeroplane I'd ever come across. And so I promptly volunteered for the NAT.
Yeah,
and on the NAT instructing at Valley, to my surprise, I really enjoyed it.
Mm.
Seeing guys get to grips with the NAT, which was a demanding aeroplane, and quite a little high. It was a hell of a jump from a Jet Provost to a NAT.
Yeah.
It was extremely rewarding. And then when I was promoted, I thought, well, that's me, my instructing done. And they said, no, you're going to go and fly Jet Provost and be a Jet Provost Squadron Commander at Cramall. Oh, God. But there again, I realised that some of my rather snooty attitude was overplayed. No, there was no plan because I commanded a squadron there for, I don't know, just over a year. Then I became Deputy Chief Flying Instructor. It was fine. And I was just doing my job when one day I just got this telephone call. Would I please go down to Flying Training Command and report to the Commander-in-Chief? Well, I mean, that didn't happen to people.
Yeah.
If it did, normally it was bad news.
Yeah.
And that's when I went down there, and I was the very first question I was asked by Air Marshal Hodgkinson, who I was to work for actually later on also, said, how would you like to be the Prince of Wales' flying instructor? Now, that was a bolt from the blue, I can tell you.
Yeah.
At that stage, there's people think I did all his flying instruction. That is not right.
Mm.
He had been a member of the University Air Squadron at Cambridge when he was there. His instructor was a chap called the Squadron Leader Phil Pinney, who was an old Cramwellian, and so on. And Prince Charles decided that he wanted to earn his wings, Royal Air Force wings, and to have done the full course, which people did in those days, to get his wings.
Mm.
And that's basically how he came into the Air Force, and he joined the first graduate entry going through Cranwell. I was sent down, I was detached down to the Queen's Flight, because at that stage they had this aeroplane called a Bassett, which is a little twin prop thing. Oh, yeah. Gossy little aeroplane, that's by the way. And I converted onto the Basset, got an instructor's ticket on the Basset, and I had to get an Air Transport Command instrument rating on it as well. And when Phil went, I used to fly him around in it or do a bit of instructing. I mean, I would sit in the right-hand seat, Prince Charles would fly in the left-hand seat and do the flying, do a bit of instructing and so on. But it was very helpful because I got to know him before the big day when he joined the Royal Air Force and we started flying training properly.
He too seems quite passionate about flying and aircraft, but there were some challenges that you and some hoops you had to get through in terms of putting in effect that heir to the throne in an aircraft. How difficult did that make your job in terms of qualifying him?
I was very well aware of the responsibility, obviously. And to put it mildly, Flying Training Command at the time were deeply worried about his safety. I mean, they really were. And the operation order that came out, you know, about his flying training and how it was to be conducted and so on and so forth, was very, very detailed. And all sorts of things were set up to minimise, quote, the risk to the heir to the throne. Like, for example, the two aeroplanes that we had, which were Jet Provost Mark V, which, dare I say, was a huge improvement, in my view, on both the Mark III and the Mark IV, were almost custom built. We had our own airmen under a flight lieutenant within a flight sergeant who worked on those aeroplanes, did their servicing exclusively. All major components were half-lifed, you know, like booster pumps, hydraulic pumps and things like that. So, you know, it was very, very tightly prescribed. In fact, too tightly. On the Monday morning of every week during that summer, I used to have to go and see the commandant at Cramwell. There's a super guy called Air Vice Marshal Desmond Hughes. And I would tell him what we'd done in the last week and how Prince Charles was progressing so he could talk to headquarters, Flying Training Command, and what we were planning to do the next week. Well, the hours that had been allocated, if I remember, were just in excess of something like 100 hours flying in the Jet Provost. That's both dual and solo. But when he went away at weekends, I used to have to go down to Benson. I used to fly down to Benson in the Jet Provost on a Friday, pick the Basset up, fly it back to Cramwell, and then fly him up to Scotland. He went and spent a lot of time going up to Scotland, first of all, and then elsewhere playing his favourite pastime or sport at the time, which was polo. And then bring him back to Cramwell on Sunday afternoon, evening, drop him off, then fly down to Benson in the Basset, stay there overnight. And then in the morning, I'd pick the Jet Provost up and I'd fly back to Cramwell early and I would be there. And one morning, I couldn't get back to Cramwell because of the weather. And so I arrived late. And when I went up to the office that we had, he said, "Well, where have you been?" And I sort of looked at him and I said, "Well, I've been at Benson for the night." He said, "What do you mean?" And I then explained what it. He said, "This is ridiculous." And I said, "Yeah, I know it's ridiculous. We could go everywhere twice, three times as quickly if we use the Jet Provost and so on." And he said, "Well, why can't we?" And I said, "Because Flying Training Command says this is the hour, blah, blah, blah." They were not concerned about risk, dare I say, and it probably sounds a bit cynical, if I was flying a Queen's Flight aeroplane. Do you understand what I mean? And so I said, "Well, can I have your agreement that I go to the commandant formally on your behalf?" He said, "Yes." So I said to Air Marshal Hughes, I said, "The Prince of Wales has formally requested that in future, when we're flying at weekends, as opposed to using the Basset, can we use the Jet Provost?" That went up to Training Command. Yes, it was all agreed, which meant he therefore got far more flying in the Provost, in the Piston Provost. Not the Piston Provost, sorry, the Jet Provost Mark V. Eventually, he ended up, with, I think, about 140, 150 hours. So we did make the most of it. And other things, that as they got more confident, well, Training Command got more confident and realised also that he was a very natural pilot, allowed us to extend the envelope as it was.
Tell us the story of how he got to fly.
I mean, when we started formation flying, he was very quick, you know, to settle in to both, you know, Echelon Port, Echelon Starboard, and no problem at all. You know, it seems going very well. But when we went into line astern, and I'd never come across this with a student before, I don't know what it was. I mean, you'd get, most people found that the easiest permission to the position to fly him. But he would get this pilot-induced oscillation.
Right.
And it was a slight over-controlling on the ailerons, and so he'd end up doing
right,
this.
Okay. Yeah.
I tried everything. I said, look, for goodness, just calm down, relax, and so on. Can you do those other two? No, why can't you do this? And so he'd sit there. And I said, look, how do you relax? And I think he said something along the lines, well, I sort of hum tunes and sing to myself. And I said, well, do that. And he suddenly burst into, Rule Britannia, I think. And then he did the most immaculate imitation of Noel Coward singing Mad Dogs and Englishmen, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And all of a sudden, he relaxed.
Yeah.
And there we were, absolutely perfect in line astern. And his formation flying was one of his great strengths in all three positions.
Wow.
But I did miss the musical accompaniment.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. Let me take you on then further in your career. I wanted to talk about the Falklands as well on your little visit down there. And I suppose it linked to the Harrier discussion earlier. Tell us a little bit about your visit to the Falklands and what you saw down there. It was just after the end of cessations.
It was a little bit longer than that. I went down there in December 82. In fact, I'd asked to go earlier because we had one of my squadrons at Goodislow was down there, plus our RAF regiment squadron, 63 squadron RAF regiment were down there. In fact, 63 squadron were the last formed unit to come back from the Falklands campaign. But whatever, I forget, I think 3 squadron were down there at the time. Having taken over, I can't quite remember, 143, whatever. And I was told, no, can't go. Far too many commanding officers of detached units are asking to go down there, et cetera, et cetera. So I sort of argued a bit, didn't get anywhere. And then we just moved into December when I suddenly got a phone call from RAF Germany, pack your bags, go down to the Falklands, because we need, the Harriers are going to be in for a long stay, and we want you to go down there, look at the size of the detachment, what's needed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So having then had to get my PA to cancel all my arrangements with the local German people, authorities and so on, I whizzed across to Bryce, got on a VC-10, went to Ascension Island, got onto a Herc, and off we went on the famous air bridge. And if I could just divert there, I mean, the air bridge that was kept going for, over 3 years and principally involved Hercules aircraft. The people who did that never have received the acknowledgement that they did, because that was a very, very demanding exercise with in-flight refueling, obviously from Victors initially and then Herc to Herc and so on. And the fact that they did it without loss of an aircraft, I think, is something which the people involved have never had the due credit paid for.
Do you think because you were more of a pilot than a politician, you were able to see some of those things?
Well, yeah, well, obviously. I mean, by then, of course, I'd done my tour as a director of air staff briefing during the Knot Defence Review. But no, I never considered myself a politician. I was an operator.
Yeah.
And, I mean, on the first trip down there in a Herc, the guy flying it, very sadly, snapped a probe off on the first refuel. And we had to turn back and go back to Ascension Island. So that was 10 hours getting nowhere. And then we got down the next day. And 4 squadron were down there, commanded by Wing Commander Tony McKeon, who was a very old chum going back to Aden days. Mm-hmm. And he'd been on 3 squadron with me when I was boss of 3 as well. And he met me. And, I mean, the airfield was still shambles, basically, from the mess the Argentinians have made of it. And I shared a tent with him. That was quite funny because on the very, when I sort of dumped the stuff in the tent, Tony said, if you need a pee during the evening, he said, just a minute, go out the tent flaps, turn left, walk 6 paces, I think it was, and there you'll find the portaloo.
Yeah.
If you haven't found the portaloo, in 6 paces, stand still and call for help. And I said, why is that? And he said, let me show you. And we went out there and there was this wire the other side of the portaloo, and it said minefield.
Yeah.
And you saw these nasty anti-personnel plastic mines that the Argentinians had left behind, where the sand had blown off them and so on. So that, you know, you suddenly realised this wasn't quite sort of Germany, let alone anywhere else.
Well, let me talk about some of the influences and the senior position.
I flew down there, by the way. I did my combat air patrols, you know.
Yes, I did. I saw that.
God, I felt a fighter pilot.
If I've got time, I'm going to come back and talk about all the aircraft flown.
Sure.
But it's a long list.
Let me
talk about or ask you some questions about how you built up your experience and knowledge, because you did some time at the Royal College of Defence Studies.
Yeah.
You studied a lot of history as well. What impact did the studies have on your view on the future of air power when you were Chief of Staff?
Well, I've always been a greedy reader. You know, I've always read a lot, and military history has always been a fascination for me. RCDS was a great year, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But of course, that was far more concerned with developing one's thinking from the operational to the strategic level, the interplay of government health agencies, and goodness knows what else. But I mean, we didn't sit at RCDS and discuss air power and think about air power very much. You know, that was not the object of the exercise. But certainly, the time that I spent in the Harrier Force, and certainly the relationships I struck up with the Army when I was at Gütersloh in particular, over at Bielefeld, did make me think very much about the development of air power, and certainly perhaps even more so about the conduct of joint operations. And then after RCDS, when I went back to Germany as a senior air staff officer, my war appointment was Commander Air First British Corps. And I did 3 years, and I went out on all the major army exercises, the core training exercises and so on, working in the core headquarters, deployed core headquarters. I'm pretty grotty. You know, I mean, living in filthy cellars, you know, and things like that.
But you weren't afraid to use the term, I suppose, muck it in where you had to. That comes
from... I mean, I'd done nearly 6 years in the Harrier Force.
Yeah.
And so, you know, swanning around in the mud and all the rest of it, and field living.
Yeah.
No, I knew all about that. So, so there was nothing strange there at all. And the Corps commanders that I worked for, Lieutenant General Brian Kenny to start with, and then Lieutenant General Peter Inge, they were very conscious that the campaign that they would have to fight, if it came to that, was going to be a land-air campaign.
Yeah.
And in fact, during that time, I mean, it was Peter Inge in particular who required me and the commander of the Royal Artillery, that they had two heavy groups in the car, the big guns, and so on, to come up with coordinated fire plans, which we did. And so, you know, you don't get suckered into it. You just suddenly realize, you know, that your specialist knowledge in terms of air power does have a very significant part to play if you are discussing a joint operation in the proper way of actually achieving maximum effect in terms of what you apply to an enemy. So very, very much so.
Yeah. That came across really clearly, actually, and being very naive about the structure of operations, particularly in towards the end of the Cold War, it was really interesting to read the complexity of the operations and the integration and how that all worked together. And that very point you made about maximizing your power of force regardless of the service it sat in.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, but they always say no plan survives the impact of war.
So tell us about your time in NATO. You had operated both in command, but you rose to senior rank as well. How did you feel that your experience as a fighter pilot, as a commander, helped you in your role at NATO?
Well, basically, what happened in very short order was that I had been posted to Strike Command. I was the deputy commander-in-chief there. John Thompson was the commander-in-chief. And in the wake of the Cold War, the Allied Command Europe structure was being changed, and there was a new headquarters to be set up called Headquarters Allied Forces Northwest Europe. John Thompson was put there as the first commander-in-chief. I took over as CNC Strike Command from John Thompson. And sadly, John had only been there a matter of days when he had a stroke and shortly afterwards died. And so my period as CNC Strike Command only lasted for 6 weeks before I was posted across, because the headquarters was co-located at High Wycombe, to Headquarters Allied Forces Northwest Europe. My job was actually to build up a completely new NATO headquarters, nine nations represented and so on. It was a joint headquarters. In fact, two-thirds of my AOR, area of operational responsibility, was water. I had great responsibilities with the Baltic as well as the Norway and so on and so forth. I found it absolutely fascinating and challenging. And great fun too at times, but we were a supporting commander for operations in the Balkans, so I spent a lot of time going backwards and forwards down there. But actually getting the staff, which was very Navy heavy, to work together as a composite headquarters was a challenge. It was an interesting challenge and one that was great fun. But I had one big thing working for me. One, I knew about soldiers.
Yeah.
And most importantly, I've been director of operations for Gulf War One, Operation Granby, in the JHQ, when, again, I had a multidisciplined or multi-service staff working for me, Army, Navy, Air Force, in all the disciplines. Yeah. And so that background was hugely beneficial when it came to setting up Headquarters Allied Forces Northwest Europe, when I did that job for, 2 years, 7 months, something like that. And went all over the place. And in fact, that's when I went to fly on the Theodore Roosevelt. And I flew with other NATO air forces as well. Including
and
one.
Did you find, we all have different cultures.
Yeah.
The different nations have different cultures. How challenging was that to work?
Well, I was worried about that. In fact, look, putting aside the Americans and the Brits in the headquarters and looking at Europe generally, the most aggressive and efficient military element in the headquarters, and I thought practically, were the German Navy.
Yeah,
they were unlike the Air Force. Dare I say, I used to find fairly steady, sort of run of the mill type stuff, if I can put it that way. I never had hardly any experience of the German Army, but by goodness, the German Navy people—they seemed a different breed. And the ships they had at the time, these fast patrol boats, gunboats, were incredibly heavily armed. I went to sea with them. And it was just like something, dare I say, I don't mean this in a derogatory sense, like a Second World War movie. It really was. And so there were different work ethics as well. I mean, the Norwegians, for example, I mean, they came in at 8, left at 4. And if they worked after 4, they got overtime. Well, this was all until they discovered that the Norwegian MOD had not made any budgetary allowance for overtime. And when we were starting to have to send people down to the Balkans and the rest of it, I thought there might be a bit of trouble, but there wasn't, because everyone was concentrating on making a success of the whole exercise and making sure that it worked properly. Yeah.
Wonderful.
So it was wonderful. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Let me talk about the Ministry of Defence then.
Yeah.
Is it fair for me to say not necessarily the most enjoyable time? Tell me what was it? Was it the politics? And I mean that in a big or a small P. Was it the people? Or was it potentially just some of the intellect that wasn't there to understand
the complexity? I think that very much from a personal perspective, when I went there, when I left 3 Squadron in back end of 77, I went into the Directorate of Forward Policy. And I shared an office with a hugely likable, incredibly talented man called John Willis, who went on to be Vice Chief of the Defence Staff when I was CAS, who I knew vaguely before from Cramwell days. And that actually was fun. I mean, if you've got to do a ground tour, sharing an office with a guy like John Willis and thinking long-term about the future of the Air Force, what equipment it was going to have, and all the sort of things we've done, which I've gone into far more detail in the book, was fun. And I thought, you know, that I would do a full tour as a staff officer before, if I was going to get promoted, you know, at least a couple of years. Well, I'd only been there for about 14 months when I was suddenly made an acting group captain and was posted as DASB, Director of Air Staff Briefing, which was essentially CAS's briefing officer. Which was, dare I say, another big bolt from the blue. And I really did wonder whether I was up to it. You know, this was a very, well, probably the most high-profile group captain job in the Ministry of Defence at the time. And I was working for Michael Beetham, Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Sir Michael Beetham, who I'd known for some time. I'd worked for him in Aden, Staff College, Germany, and so on. And I knew he was a bomber man, a very distinguished bomber man, and a very hard man indeed. And I knew that working for him was not going to be a bed of roses. And it wasn't. I worked for him as DASB for two and a third year, something like that. And it was hard graft. It really was hard graft. Now, all the details of what I have to do, I won't sort of bore you with all that. But why didn't I like that, the Ministry of Defence? I think probably this was during the time of the Not Defence Review. Well, the change of government. When I went there, Callaghan was Prime Minister. Yeah. Prime Minister Thatcher came in with the Conservative administration. And shortly afterwards, the first Secretary of State, Pym, got fired, then Nott came in, Defence Review. And basically, the situation was money had to be saved, as ever. Mm. Army could sit on the fence. They had this 65 kilometres of front in Europe, which was theirs, and which they were declared to NATO to defend. Yeah. And, of course, they had Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And so the army felt, well, they can't touch us. And so it boiled down to the normal acrid, whatever you want to call it, battle between the Navy and the Air Force. And eventually the Air Force won. And I should go back one and say, which was of the greater strategic and operational relevance, Air Force or the Navy?
Yeah.
The Navy at that time, what was their job? Their job, basically, apart from obviously the strategic nuclear deterrent, SSBNs and so on, was bringing across the reinforcements from the Atlantic and so on.
Yeah.
All the other jobs that they had all around the world, and I had a great deal of sympathy for their position at the time, were basically to deal with the unexpected. But it's very difficult to be subjective about the unexpected by definition, whereas the Royal Air Force had very firm declarations to NATO about number of aircraft, et cetera, and indeed there were quite clearly weaknesses in our air defence at the time. So the Air Force won that battle, as it were. Mark you, everything then got turned upside down 2 years later with the Falklands campaign. But the relationships in the Ministry of Defence at the time amongst uniformed people were poisonous. And I didn't like that one little bit.
No.
I mean, I've got friends from those days, even today. By and large, they were poisonous. And I thought, gosh, you know, we're all supposed to be on the same side. But we quite clearly aren't. Why aren't we? Politics, money, etc. I didn't like it. And I was very pleased to get out of it and have a breath of fresh air. And I swore to myself, I'm never going to go back to that bloody place again.
Which, of course, bolt out of the blue. You do speak quite highly in your book about George Robertson and John Reid during their respective periods of Secretary of State of Defence. Maybe less so about those that followed.
Well, John Reid was Minister for the Armed Forces.
Right, okay.
George Robertson was Secretary of State for Defence.
Yeah.
And John Reid was a Minister for the Armed Forces.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, what in your opinion then makes a good politician who's in charge in a senior role in the defence?
Well, I mean, if you take the example of George Robertson, I'll take the example of both of them. George Robertson was the first to admit when he came to the Ministry of Defence, he knew very little, if anything, about defence. John Reid did. John Reid had been an opposition spokesman on defence, and he was passionately interested in defence. Many conservatives, and I am apolitical, so I don't make this in a political sense. Trouble with many of the conservative people who had defence positions was they'd all done a bit of service. You know, they'd either done national service, some of them had been short service commissions. And they came in full of, you know, inspired by politics, saying, I know about defence, you know, because I did this, that, and the other, and so on. And they were either arrogant. I can certainly think of one who I thought was desperately arrogant, or don't bother to tell me because I know all that sort of stuff. Now, George Robertson came in to learn, and he listened, and by jingo, did he ever listen, and he would be taking notes the whole time. But also, he was, dare I say, and I hope this doesn't sound patronising, if he was listening to this, I can imagine the laugh he would give. I mean, he was a politician, and he was very, very clever. And he could see the weaknesses in any argument, you know, that you put in front of him. John Reid was far more combative. A discussion with John Reid, well, I used to thoroughly enjoy them. Because he, again, would be prepared to listen. And the two of them together, I thought, were a very formidable team. And what they did in producing the Strategic Defence Review of 1997-98 was a great credit both to them and to the government of the time, until, of course, it came to funding. And again, you know, what happened was the good old Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, wouldn't fund the Ford equipment program as it was required to be funded. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Tony Blair, much encouraged by success in the Balkans, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, and so on, developed this appetite for military adventurism, which led us into Iraq and then led us into dual. This was after my time, by the way. So I'm sort of talking off the top of my head, as it were. But I thought, you know, then that we were, we were bound to get a bloody nose sooner or later, and we did, of course, with dual deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq, which were absolutely counter to all the defence planning assumptions that underwrote the outcome of the Strategic Defence Review of
97-98. Right. Yeah, fascinating.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
I just want to ask you a particular question about Nimrod.
Oh, yes. Are you talking about Nimrod MR4A?
I was quite interested to read about your preference for the Orion, actually, in terms of potentially being an opportunity to kit that out with UK sensors and systems. But I just want to hear your view about Nimrod, because you...
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember when I arrived there at CAS, I had been out of the Royal Air Force for the best part of 3 years doing my NATO job. So you come in there, and I inherited from my predecessor, Mike Graydon, a really great forward equipment program that he had managed to protect and set in place. The one aeroplane that caused me concern in it was Nimrod, the maritime Nimrod. And why? From my previous tour in the Ministry of Defence, way back when I was DASBY, I was fully aware of the story of NIMWAX, which you may remember was the effort to make a Nimrod not a, sorry, a Comet aeroplane into an airborne early warning type system. Much against the advice of many, basically because you just couldn't cram all the gear that was required with all the stations, you know, the operating stations, into a 1950s type fuselage. And so I can't remember how much money was wasted before it was finally binned. Yeah. And we went and did what we should have done all along and went and got AWACS. So, you know, you suddenly, I asked to have a look at the paperwork. I'd actually seen the model of the Nimrod MR4A down at Farnborough, and it looked very smart. Mm. Nice glass cockpit, everything else, you know, new engines and so on, much easier to serve, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, it looked good. But I, remembering AWACS, could not persuade myself that given the requirement, the very broad operational requirement for that aeroplane and so on, they were going to cram into precisely the same size fuselage all the stuff that was needed to do the job.
Yeah.
And if they did cram it in, again, you know, because I tend to be intuitive about these things, getting the whole thing to knit together and work was, again, a very, very high-risk venture.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, here we go again. We're going to pour an awful lot of money into that aeroplane and probably get nowhere. George Robertson was aware of my concerns, and I spoke to him about it. He said, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd phone up my chum in Washington, Admiral J. Johnson, who's the boss of the U.S. Navy, and say, you know those 120 P-3 Orions that you've got stuck down in the Nevada desert? Can we have 24 or whatever?
Yeah.
Absolute knockdown cost. All we want are the engines of the airframes. Because I've flown in them with my great chum Snuffy Smith, who was sink south, huge fuselage, and so on, and they've done it anyway, and we'll put all the systems in and so on. George Robertson, you know, it was quite interesting, but then of course the word got out, and the weight of BA systems fell down on me.
Yeah,
you know, what the hell do you think you're doing? This is going to blah blah blah, and all the rest of it. Fair enough, that's their job, make them flog aeroplanes.
Yeah.
I still wasn't convinced, but then George Robertson said to me, of course, they came out with, I can't remember what the numbers were, but it was something along the lines that, well, if we cancel it, we're going to put 1,200 people out of work at Wharton. And I remember George Robertson saying to me something along the lines that, do you know how many Labour, how many constituencies there are around Wharton? I said, no, I think there were three or something like that, all Labour held.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was the end of that. And then, of course, 10 years later, it gets scrubbed. Mm. And we end up with no MPA aeroplanes.
Yeah, we did. We did. One final question then on inter-service collaboration, but also the outcome of decisions you made. Just want to talk about the UK carrier strike proposition and where we are now and where we were. And you were working at the time with the First Sea Lord Jock Slater.
Correct.
And you were asked by the Secretary of State, George Robinson, to agree what we should do in terms of the future.
No, that's not quite the way around it worked.
Okay.
What basically happened was that when the gun was fired to start the Strategic Defence Review, very shortly after New Labour came into power, I didn't know Jock well at the time. We had met before, but we got together and we sat down for a long chat. And we both of us, of course, had lived through the Not Defence Review. And we agreed that the civil service and all the bean counters would expect the Navy and the Air Force to bid each other's throats.
Yeah.
And they would all end up laughing all the way to the Treasury once we had torn each other to shreds. Mm. And again, the argument probably would center on aircraft carriers because the Invincible class were coming to the end of their time.
Yeah.
And Jock and I agreed that we would, you know, try to come to sensible decisions between ourselves, and we would only escalate it, as it were, to the Secretary of State if we sort of ran into a brick wall. So Jock said, well, are you going to back the replacement of the Invincible class carriers? And I said, well, we're going to have to wait, in my view, because the Strategic Defence Review was in two parts. The first part was basically about the UK strategic interests. What do we need militarily to meet government defence policy derived from the strategic overview? And the question was, were we going basically to remain in the power projection business with an intervention capability, or were we going to draw our horns in and become a big Belgian in NATO, to put it crudely? And so we agreed that we'd wait to see what the decision was. And as you well know, the decision was we will keep power projection in and so on. Yeah. I said, in that case, I will back the replacement of the Invincible class carriers with two brand spanking new carriers. And I thought at the time that the Navy would probably go for something like the Wasp class carriers that the US Marine Corps had. They seemed, you know, from what I could see, because I'm no expert on ships or ship design, seemed just about the ticket. And the agreement was, as given to the House of Commons Defence Committee, in evidence, was they would be 30 to 40,000 ton ships.
Yeah.
That was the agreement when I and Jock left the service.
Yeah.
How they have morphed into these 65,000, 70,000 ton carriers, with more space in them than we're going to have aeroplanes to put in them, don't ask me that question. I have my own views on that, but I'm not prepared to go public. But I think, you know, a huge, huge error.
Yeah.
And particularly when, you know, they're great adverts for the British shipbuilding industry. I have absolutely no doubts about that at all. But their strategic and operational significance, well, not so sure.
Yeah.
And moreover, of course, in terms of the overspend on those ships, that took very valuable money out of the total defence budget, which arguably, of course, could be spent
in other areas.
In other areas, yeah.
Okay. One of the great successes, great achievements you did have, though, was getting the C-17 into the portfolio. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the operational requirement existed when I took over from Mike Graydon.
Yeah.
And there were all sorts of runs. The C-17 obviously was an obvious run. There was an Antonov aeroplane and I forget whatever. But it was perfectly clear that once you sat down and looked at the specification required, there was only one aeroplane that met it.
Yeah.
And that was the C-17. Well, I think it dragged on. Every meeting I went to, you know, with the Defence Council or the Financial Planning Management Group or whatever, I became, every time, you know, as all sorts of other things were floating around, I would say, no, the only aeroplane that meets the operational requirement is the C-17. And actually, I'd flown in one as well. I had a bloody good look around it, the United States Air Force one. And I'd had a look at the Antonov, I remember, down at the Royal International Air Tattoo, etc. And eventually, dare I say, we got our way in the sense that the government agreed that we could lease four. We wanted 11.
Yeah.
The ideal fleet at the time was 130Js, Herc 130Js, and 11 C-17s.
Yeah.
The A400M, which also had my BDI on, too late. That was already, you know, well underway in the program and so on. And that obviously would have had some effect on thinking. But the irony is that we would never have got the C-17 if we hadn't agreed to a leasing arrangement.
Right.
The greater irony is that by the time the contract was over and paid all the leasing charges, we had spent enough money to buy the bloody 11 that we wanted in the first place. But that's the Ministry of Defence and that's the procurement executive for you.
But it's very sad.
But I'm very glad we got it, because those aeroplanes saved a lot of lives during Afghanistan.
Yep. And does the fact that we operate in an international environment, is there... You know, we talked about inter-service collaboration.
Yeah.
What about collaboration with our partners? Did choosing that sort of aircraft make any difference to our joint operations with the United States, for example?
What, do you mean the C-17?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. Obviously, we had people flying with the United States Air Force, flying the C-17 before we took delivery of our first one.
Right.
So we had people to fly the aeroplane from the word go.
Yeah.
But our relationships with the United States Air Arms have always been very close.
Yeah.
I think probably far closer than the British Army's relationships were with the U.S. Army.
Yeah.
And probably with the Navy as well. I'm not quite so sure about that. But, I mean, we've been flying on operations with the United States Air Force for a long time. I mean, well, more recently, of course, during Gulf War I, over the Balkans, North and Southern Watch and so on.
Yeah.
So we knew each other well. And I think there was a mutual confidence, though, of course, I mean, their capabilities were, significantly larger, hugely larger than ours. And we've always had RAF people flying with the United States Air Force and with the US Navy. Mm. People forget that.
I wanted to ask you about the US Navy, particularly because I wanted to know what you thought of the F-14 Tomcat. You got the opportunity to have a go.
Well, I'll never forget my first takeoff. I mean, wow. I mean, that was, as they say in Americanism, was awesome.
Yeah.
I was just fascinated the 5 days or so I had on Theodore Roosevelt as it was completing its workup. I mean, as I said in the book, I think, you know, that because we're going back now to when, I forget, it was when I was doing my NATO job, so it would have been about 96-ish, I guess. They had three Nimitz-class battle groups at sea at any one stage, protected by, and think of this in terms of Queen Elizabeth, six surface ships, anti-aircraft ships, Aegis-class cruisers or whatever, forget, and so on, with also an anti-submarine capability. Always one hunter-killer underneath the carrier, quite often two.
Yeah.
That's how. And you have three of these huge battle groups at sea at any one stage, and with on board, not roughly, I don't know, 90 to 100 type aeroplanes covering every airborne operational role. And then three more refitting and three more training to replace, nine of them, three to go. Now, when you combine that with the global reach of the United States Air Force, and particularly, of course, when it got the B-2 into service as well and the rest of it, I don't think that many people have a full appreciation, and I guess it's still very much the same today, of quite the power of the air power of the United States, and of course the power into space beyond and so on, which becomes ever increasing importance.
So let me ask you again about the Tomcat.
Oh, the Tomcat. Well, I mean,
we all love the Tomcat.
Well, I mean, I'm no expert in the air defense or contemporary air defense role. I mean, my air defense days in a Javelin are very, very different from what they are today. I mean, to me, it just seemed a hugely capable aeroplane.
Yeah.
You know, we whizzed around, and I didn't do any operations in it. It was just just flying the aeroplane for the sake of flying it and seeing what it was like. And I can remember that, you know, when you landed, I mean the carrier, to me, people say that they always look like a postage stamp. Well, perhaps it's my Harrier background, you know, with a 70-foot bit of tin. But you look, and the carrier looked absolutely huge to me. And I thought, let's see all the fuss is about.
Yeah.
And because when you land and you hit the deck hard, poof, off goes full power. They go straight up to full power.
Yeah.
And then back it comes again once they're sure they've got the hook. Well, fair enough. But it was taxiing in that got me, because I was in the back cockpit, obviously, and with the nose wheel behind you, you had to do a 180 turn into your parking slot, and boy, are they parked tight.
Yeah.
And of course, when you're doing the 180, all of a sudden you're looking down at the sea. I found that slightly discomforting.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But the aeroplane itself was incredible. And then, as I say, when I was talking to the air boss, on one of my tours of the ship, you know, there was a lull in flying, and I just said as a joke, you know, I said, "That's a nice way to earn your monthly check." And he said, "Yeah," he said, "but we earn it at night."
Yeah,
and you know, I believe him.
We'll leave that.
I didn't fly with them at night.
Let me go to the other end of the spectrum, then, Sir Richard, and ask you about when you were in Romania and the flight in the MiG-21.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That just sounded frightening.
Well, I mean, it was actually, looking back on it, I had two staff officers with me. And the intelligence briefing that I got before I went there, I mean, it's no secrets, you know, said that, like most of the satellite air forces, you know, that, you know, since the Soviet Union had fallen apart, you know, they'd all been equipped by the Soviet Union, ergo they had MiG-21s. Yeah. The price of spares had gone off near 300% more, and so on, and they were getting very, very little flying. Their airplanes weren't, you know, particularly well serviced, they were pretty worn out. And on this particular day, I was asked to wear, you know, a flying suit, so I paired down at the airfield with my host. And we watched. Actually, it was quite 24 MiG-21s were lined up. 21 pilots came out, all marched out, as they do, and they got in. 21 actually got airborne, and they did a simulated airfield attack, which I didn't, to be quite honest, think was all that tactical, but that was by the way. One made polite noises.
Yeah.
And then I was taken into the crew room, and I sat down, and this chap started briefing me. And he had an interpreter. He didn't speak English, and it was a station commander. And the interpreter's grasp of matters aviation, it was, as I say, wasn't all that clear. And it suddenly started to dawn on me with an awful sort of feeling that I was going to go fly in the MiG-21 with him when he demonstrated to me his low-level aerobatic sequence. And I thought, oh. I thought, this is the time you close your eyes and you think of England. And my two staff officers were absolutely aghast. And we got into this aeroplane. There was no flight safety briefing. I do remember that very clearly. Got into the back seat of this MiG-21. Obviously, it was a two-seater. And I noticed the tyres were absolutely threadbare. And, you know, a few straps were stuck into me. I got no briefing on the bang seat or anything anything like that. And the next minute, the thing was fired up. We roared off. We were whizzing down the runway, full burner, cranked in. I always remember we cranked into a hard starboard turn, very low, rolled out, accelerated, and up we went. And I was trying to sort out the instruments in the back cockpit.
And they were?
In metric measurements.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And of course, Cyrillic script.
In Cyrillic,
that's right. And as we started pulling up, I thought, we're going to loop. Now, I know enough about looping to know that you've got to have a gate height at the top if you're going to miss the ground on the way down. Now, I didn't know what the gate height was, but I thought I'll make a note of it, you know, just for future reference. And we came out, we pulled out of the loop, and we then went on with this sequence. We're basically full afterburner most of the time, lots of G, and so on, until the final thing was this inverted run down the runway at about 100 feet. And as he rolled the airplane inverted, and then stuck forward the stick, I had about minus two, something like that. I just, wasn't strapped in properly or tight. I just collapsed into the canopy. My head was banging around the canopy. And I thought, oh, no.
Yeah.
And as I said to George Robertson in my report, by God, I don't half earn the flying pay I no longer get. And we landed, eventually landed. I flopped back into the seat when he turned the thing the right way up. We landed, we taxied, and there were all the squadron pilots, two very released officers. They all clapped politely. And I got presented with my Romanian Air Force Wings first class, which was bloody good, when the only controls I had touched were the rudder bar, so I wanted somewhere to put my feet.
Very good.
But I've never forgotten that one.
Yeah, that's quite amazing. And as I said, you flew almost everything in the inventory. But let me come towards...
two airplanes I didn't fly I'd love to have flown. One was the Canberra. Never flew the Canberra, and I never flew the Buccaneer.
Oh, the Buccaneer would have been an interesting one.
Very much so, and I deeply regret that, because people I do know whose opinions I really respect speak most highly of that aeroplane.
Mm. Yeah. You did as well. You flew all types. You flew helicopters.
Yeah.
You flew the heavies as well as, the fighter aircraft. I suppose the ultimate question is, what was the favourite?
Well, I told you earlier on, the Hunter 10.
Yeah.
Must be.
Yeah.
Must be.
Beautiful aircraft.
Oh, I mean, cliched saying, if it looks good, it flies good.
Yeah.
Is so, so true.
Yeah.
And I mean, all the Hunters did.
Yeah.
I converted on the 6. The 7, the two-seater, obviously. And then the 9, which is the ground attack version, and the 10. But I was very fortunate to be on a unit where we just flew tens.
Yeah,
that was lovely.
Wonderful. At the end of your towards your retirement, you were considered as a potential candidate for Chief of the Defence Staff.
No, I think that puts it a little bit too strongly. Charles Guthrie.
You were approached.
Guthrie, who was Chief of the Defence Staff, said to me, "Would you like to be considered?" As my successor. And funny enough, I just been in his office. We used to, we used to have a chat, an hour's chat every week. And he suddenly had to get out. I got a meeting. And I think he was probably going off to speak to the Secretary of State then, about possible success. And he asked me, and I said, no, I don't. And he sort of smiled. Charles feels very strongly, and always, I think, has felt strongly, that only soldiers should be chief of the defence staff.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily agree with him, but I can see how where he comes from and why he feels that.
Yeah. Why did you not feel that that would be something you would want?
I just think I'd be very good at it,
right?
To be quite honest.
That's very humble of you.
Well, it's not humble. I mean, in fact, we used to have appraisal reports, which New Labour, and even chiefs of the air staff, had to have an appraisal report written on them.
Yeah.
And Charles very kindly said on mine that in terms about being CDS, that I'd be readily accepted by the other two services, which was very, very nice. But he did say, and he was absolutely right, that I might have some difficulty in finding my way around the labyrinth of Whitehall and Westminster, and he was absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't make many political friends, I didn't make many friends in the civil service or whatever when I was there. Mm. And whatever, I just felt, if I had done that, I'd have been a fish out of water.
Yeah. You're very honest to yourself in terms of your capabilities and what you've achieved. But in this year of 100 years of the RAF, a lot has happened. You've talked about a lot of people that that you respected, but I think it's quite clear that there's a lot of people who respect you as well and the leadership you gave to the Air Force. What do you feel was your lasting legacy when you retired?
I like to feel, well, two things. First of all, I mean, the Air Force took an awful battering in the 1990s. It really did. And what really made me so angry, in fact, actually, funny, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I thought it needs to be recorded, was that while we were being cut back savagely, I mean, after, what, two so-called reviews, options for change and defence cost studies, as the Air Force was reducing from 93,000 down to about 55,000, while we had lost squadron after squadron out of the front line, in the immediate wake of Gulf War I, as though it had never happened, we were being asked to take on more and more. Now, I was at a thing up at Newcastle University where I was speaking only the other night. And, I mean, as I said, no one knows, for example, well, obviously there are some people because they did it, that between 1992 and 1996, Royal Air Force Hercules flew 20 tons of supplies each week into Sarajevo, when under a UN mandate. And they did that for 4 years. Mm. They got shot at by angry Serbs, goodness knows what. No one knows about that. Mm. No one knows that in 1994, we did 6,000 hours flying, and that's the Tornadoes, the GRs, that is, and the Harriers and Jaguars over north and south Iraq. No one knows in the same year we did 10,000 hours flying on Danai flight over the Balkans.
Yeah.
While at one and the same time, the service was being cut, contractorized. And that's one of the reasons I wrote that book, because that needs to be actually recorded by someone who was actually involved in it and saw it happening. And so, as I said, the Air Force had a very, very rough ride during those years. And what I like to think, and what did I do in my 3 years as CAS? I like to think that perhaps I gave the Air Force back a bit of its pride in what it was doing. Because I used to talk endlessly about this to people. I mean, in the House of Commons, when they had to go and brief the Parliament and so on.
Yeah.
And say, you don't know what your Air Force is doing for you.
Yeah.
This is what it's damn well doing.
Yeah.
And you should acknowledge it. Well, sadly, the Air Force, even today, gets very little acknowledgement for what it actually does, because people don't see it. And you can't squeeze a journalist into a typhoon cockpit, for example, as well as you can embed journalists into an army battalion or a ship at sea.
Yeah.
So I felt very, very strongly about that. And if I did manage to put some pride back into the Royal Air Force in itself, I think that personally, if people feel that I achieved that, I would feel very proud. I'm proud myself. I like to think also that one gave it some confidence in the future.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that that I was probably misplaced in doing that, in the way that that the services have been chopped away at almost continuously, the way that the chief of staff's authority has been not minimized, but has been chopped away again and again and again, I just think is very, very sad. The one glimmer of hope I see is that long last, certainly in Parliament, there are politicians who are actually beginning to state the case for defence, because it is the government's duty to protect this country.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that a majority of politicians are entirely indifferent to the armed services, although they make platitudinous cries about our brave men and women. But they do that at one and the same time, when they're cutting back on defence, cutting back on conditions of service, and goodness knows what else.
Yeah.
So I do get, as you probably gather, quite cross and worked up about this.
No, I appreciate your honesty. One final question then, Sir Richard, and it's moving on from your RAF career. What happened when you left the service? You took up a unique role. Can you just give us a tiny little bit of a flavour for what happened after you retired from the Royal Air Force?
Well, I mean, I went to Windsor Castle. Very sadly, my predecessor, General Sir Patrick Palmer, who I did know quite well, had died. He poor man got lung cancer and then died. So there had been a gap. There hadn't been a constable and governor there for about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. So I was asked if I would go there straight away, within 3 weeks of retiring. With all the benefit of hindsight, that was a mistake. It was my mistake, because I should have said no. I've done nothing else in my life except be in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And I really do need now several months to sort myself out and sort all sorts of other things out.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't do that, and that I suffered some consequences because of that, but that's by the way. But getting there and understanding, well, as a member of the Royal Household, beginning to understand one's place in the greater scheme of things. I mean, I said to the Lord Chamberlain, I said, well, what's my job? Because they had a job spec.
Yeah.
To be quite honest, it didn't make much sense to me. I thought, anyone wrote that in the service, I'd kick their backside. But he looked at me and he said, your job is to make sure the Queen doesn't have to worry about Windsor Castle. In a sense, that put it in an absolute nutshell.
Yeah.
And, of course, you lived in this community, I mean, obviously with the military knights. And, of course, you have the College of St. George in the castle, with the Dean of Windsor, still the same man, David Connor, who became and remains a very dear and close friend. And so, you sort of get into the rhythm of the year, which, of course, dare I say, is set in concrete, is almost set in concrete, like Garter Day, Easter Court, and goodness knows what else. And your job, basically, I think, is almost that of a squire. You look after the community, which is a fairly widespread community, like those, all of whom come in the Royal Collection, who work in the castle on a day-to-day business and so on, those who live in the castle, those who live in the College of St. George. And so you have a sort of influence there. What I didn't realise was I was going to pick up 14 jobs. Every one of them, of course, pro bono.
Yeah.
But, I mean, some of them are hugely interesting. I became president of the Windsor Festival.
Right, okay.
And I claim to be, a rare oddity, a cultured fighter pilot these days because of one's association with that. And all sorts of other charitable work and the rest of it. So there was more than enough to keep me busy in the castle and in the surrounding area, because you represent the Queen when she's not there in the Royal Borough, and then you're a member of a household when she is there. So there was always enough to keep you busy, and some of it was absolutely fascinating and dare I say, incredibly interesting. So I don't regret it.
Sir Richard, thank you so much for your time today. Really fascinating. And just for me personally, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed as well, Peter. Thank you.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We're extremely grateful to Judith and John at Grub Street Books for their support in producing this episode. Remember, you can get a copy of Bolts from the Blue through the Amazon link on the extended webpage. Published by Grub Street, it's 320 pages of great flying stories, political posturing, and honest human endeavours. We'd like to thank Peter Dixon and White Hearts for their support in producing our podcasts, and a big thank you to all of you listening. Without you, we'd not have the programme and great guests such as Sir Richard Johns, CBE, former Chief of the Air Staff for the Royal Air Force. You can find Extended on Twitter and on Facebook, and it's Aviation Extended, all one word. If you're interested in listening to our back catalogue, go to the website or drop us an email at getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk and we'll send you a special link to download all the episodes directly. Okay, and with that, and with the arrival of the music, I'm Peter Johnson from XTP Media. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.